This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yeheyis Wuhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
If you look at the mortality, the animals which are succumbing, they are young, and of course they can't reach for higher tree branches up there, so they ended up eating anything, and some of the plants that they eat might be poisonous. But again, it's something that is still investigated.
That's the spokesperson for Zimbabwe's National Parks and Wildlife Management Agency on the recent deaths of 22 elephants. Details coming up also. The UN says locusts are threatening Botswana, Namibia, Zambia, and Zimbabwe. And the transitional government of Sudan has signed a peace deal with a key rebel group. All these and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. But first, our top story. Zimbabwe is investigating whether the deaths of 22 elephants are related to a similar outbreak in neighboring Botswana. Adigando has the story.
Zimbabwe National Parks and Wildlife Management Agency, ZIMPARKS, confirmed yesterday that 11 more elephants have died, bringing the total to 22. Last week, 11 elephants were found dead in Pandamasuo Forest outside Wange National Park, not far from the Botswana border. Cause of death was initially suspected to be poaching and cyanide poisoning, but parks officials have since ruled that out. Tinashe Farao is the ZIMPARKS spokesperson.
We can confirm that after an aerial survey in the general area of Pandamasuo Forest, Woodlands and Zambezi, we discovered other 10 dead elephants, which means we have now discovered 22 elephants which succumbed to a suspected bacteria. We are still investigating. We will continue to take samples to the lab so that at least we know what is causing the death of these elephants.
There are fears of a link to the deaths of nearly 400 elephant deaths in May in eastern Okavango, Seronga and Delta areas. As in those deaths, poaching was ruled out because the carcasses still had their tusks intact.
If you look at the mortality, the animals which are succumbing, they are young, and of course they can't reach for higher tree branches up there, so they ended up eating anything, and some of the plants that they eat might be poisonous. But again, it's something that is still investigated.
During the dry season, wildlife and domestic animal migrations usually take place between the two countries, heightening the risk of disease spread. The Botswana government recently has been shooting and banning Zimbabwean livestock which cross into its territory in a bid to protect its own national herd from possible foot and mouth disease. Zimbabwe has an elephant population of about 80,000, which is about a fifth of the total in Africa. But the numbers have been dwindling due to a number of reasons, ranging from drought to poaching and exports. Farao says his agency needs more resources for its conservation efforts, which have been badly hit by the COVID-19 related dip in tourist arrivals.
Most of the challenges that we are facing is the issue of our overpopulation of our animals. And we think the biggest threat to the survival of our animals is loss of habitat, which is caused by the overpopulation of these animals. And they ended up encroaching into communities, killing people, injuring people.
About 200 elephants have also died since last year due to drought in southern Africa. ZIMPARKS officials say 50 people have also lost their lives due to human-wildlife conflict this year. Reporting for VOA, this is Adigondo in Bulawayo.
French President Emmanuel Macron met in Paris with Ivory Coast counterpart Alassane Ouattara as the coming election has thrown his country into turmoil. Nicolas Pinault has more for VOA.
The lunch between the two heads of state was on the official agenda of the French president, but no joint statement was issued after the meeting inside the presidential palace. The number one topic of discussion between the two men was Ouattara's surprise decision last month to seek a third term. Macron has not commented publicly on Ouattara's move, but a source in the French presidency said Thursday that his hope for a generational change in Ivory Coast remains firm. In March, France had welcomed the historic decision by Ouattara, 78, not to run for re-election, hoping the move will encourage other long-standing African leaders to embrace more democratic practices. But the death of his prime minister, who many say was supposed to succeed him, prompts a reversal that has sparked weeks of deadly clashes between supporters of rival parties. The two heads of state also discussed Mali, as the West African state is experiencing instability.
The UN says locusts are threatening Botswana, Namibia, Zambia, and Zimbabwe in an infestation unrelated to the one that has ravaged parts of eastern Africa. The UN Food and Agricultural Organization, FAO, said today that fast action is needed because the outbreaks are small now but could worsen in an area already hit by drought and COVID-19. One locust breeding area has been Botswana's well-known and wildlife-rich Okavango Delta. FAO says pesticide spraying efforts have begun in four countries but have been limited so far. The Gambia has been plagued by acute water shortages, and now businesses are being paralyzed by regular power cuts that the national utility says are costing it about 35% of its revenue. Efforts are underway to resolve the problem, reporter Panderambai reports from Raleigh, North Carolina.
If indeed the National Water and Electricity Company, NAWEC, has outsourced some of the energy needs to private foreign companies, the country is suffering its worst electricity and water shortages. NAWEC blames the growing demand for power, saying its generators can't produce enough. Nani Juara is NAWEC's managing director.
Currently, we have a number of our generating sets down, and because of that, the available capacity that we have is less than the demand. So most of the time during peak periods, we have to do some load shedding. And I know there was a lot of noise last week, particularly when we had a problem with our transmission line coming from Banjul to Kutu.
A lot of noise indeed. NAWEC customers were outraged by the constant power cuts. Even musicians like the band called Bright Stars complain. Juara has apologized to customers. He told VOA via Skype that efforts are underway to resolve the power crisis.
We have a responsibility here, and we will make sure we live up to expectation. We will ensure that we work on plans to expand the network, and at the same time have a similar plan to expand the generation capacity so that at least we are not leaving one activity behind the other, so that at least when you have more customers being connected, you would have got enough generation capacity to take care of their needs.
Juara says COVID-19 has hurt NAWEC's economic base, cutting revenue about 35% as major clients such as hotels have closed. The company is also spending heavily to fill the power gap. NAWEC is paying $24 million a year to foreign energy company Car Power to supply power to the Greater Banjul area and Senegal Senelec about 132 million CFA francs yearly to supply border villages. Juara says privatizing NAWEC wouldn't necessarily help.
Instead of entirely privatizing the company, what we are planning to do now is to encourage private investment into the generation aspect of the business. And this is the best practice in most part of the world, and we don't want to be left out.
He says the government's long-term goal is to electrify the entire country. For VOA News, this is Panderimbay reporting from Raleigh, North Carolina.
Sudan has signed a peace deal with a key rebel group that previously had refused to do so. The French news agency AFP says the Prime Minister of Sudan's transitional government and the leader of the Sudan People's Liberation Movement North, SPLMN, signed the agreement late yesterday in neighboring Ethiopia. The agreement follows a deal signed Monday with leaders of a coalition of rebel forces, the Sudan Revolutionary Front, SRF. The SRF brings together rebels from the war-ravaged western Darfur region, as well as the southern states of Blue Nile and South Kordofan, where the SPLMN is based. The latest agreement means only one key group remains still fighting, a wing of the Darfur-based Sudan Liberation Movement, SLM, led by Paris-based Abdel Wahid Noor. Fighting in Darfur has left about 300,000 people dead since 2003. Until recently, Rwanda had only 25 dentists for a population of 12 million. The shortage of oral health care, led by Health Ministry and the University of Rwanda, to partner with Harvard University and the University of Maryland to create the country's first professional dental school. The first class graduated in November 2018 to great fanfare, and those young dentists completed their internships this month. VOA's Adam Phillips spoke with Dr. Donna Hatchley, a dental instructor at Harvard School of Dental Medicine and a key player in the ongoing international partnership. She began by talking about a recent national survey on oral health in Rwanda.
We did the first national oral health survey in Rwanda, and we found that 70% of the participants in the study had never seen an oral health care provider, and they identified cost and other reasons why they weren't able to see any dental providers.
You must have seen a lot of Rwandans who have lost all their teeth as a result.
Actually, we didn't find a single person that was missing all of their teeth. Many people had decay, but most people did not have a lot of decay. We did find that almost two-thirds of them had had pain in their mouth in the year leading up to the survey. So their quality of life was definitely impacted in terms of being able to go to work, to go to school, to chew, or even feeling self-conscious about themselves.
Tooth decay and cavities are a universal problem, but the reasons for its prevalence in any one place can be very culture specific. What are the sources of the main challenges in Rwanda?
In Rwanda, the problem has been partly because of geographical terrain, partly because of cost, partly because of the small workforce and the distribution of the workforce. You know, if you live out in the bush and it's a five-hour walk to get to a place where a dental provider is, you may not be making that walk very frequently.
I saw that wonderful video and those photos of your first dental school graduation. The students looked so happy, and so did you.
It was a wonderful day. You know, the first class had so many challenges to overcome. They had to stay resilient, flexible, strong, and patient as challenges came up. Sometimes it took a bit of time, but ultimately they reached the finish line. And the first class just finished their internship for deployment into the various hospitals, and they will be distributed around the country, which is one great thing about Rwanda. They do things very equitably in terms of gender and geography.
How did you plan the program so that this would be a Rwandan achievement rather than just Westerners sort of popping in, dispensing their largesse, and just leaving?
You hit the nail right on the head. The program was a 7-year program, and it was meant to be heavy on the front end with a lot of U.S. institution involvement, and as time passed, less and less and less. So by the end of the program, Rwanda is running its schools and teaching, trainings, all on their own. So we don't go, we meaning the U.S. institution personnel, to treat patients or in most cases to directly teach the students. We go to partner with a Rwandan professional who has a job similar to ours. We work hard together. We enjoy the work, and it was absolutely developed with that frame of mind. It will carry forward as the Rwandese faculty wants it to be.
I understand that the wisdom and expertise ran both ways, that the folks from Harvard and University of Maryland learned quite a bit from the Rwandan way of doing things.
Yes, yes, that's right. We learned definitely about consensus building. We learned other ways to get things done, to think outside of the box. And some of the models that we're trying there can definitely translate back here for us.
The Rwanda Project is part of a much larger worldwide public health effort to get oral health the attention it really deserves.
Right. Oral diseases affect 3.9 billion people in the world today. That's half of the world's population. It's the most common non-communicable disease worldwide, and the social determinants of health that are related to diabetes, hypertension, cardiovascular problems are the same that are related to oral diseases. And so having oral health is just a critical piece.
That was Dr. Donna Hatchley of Harvard's School of Dental Medicine, a key player in establishing first professional dental school. She spoke with VOA's Adam Phillips from Pittsfield, Massachusetts. There have been renewed calls for the government of Ghana to close down witch camps in the country after a 90-year-old woman was lynched for being accused of practicing magic. Mavis Ochera in Ghana has more.
In 2011, the government announced it would shut the camps, but those efforts came to naught, while serving as sanctuaries for those accused of witchcraft and ostracized or attacked for it, the camps lack basic social services. The practice of magical skills, spells, and abilities is deeply ingrained in Ghanaian culture. Witches and wizards are believed to hold powers to create fortunes or mishaps and are often blamed for natural disasters, accidents, and the like in some African societies. In Ghana, stories that highlight the detection and abuse of accused witches and warlocks are mostly from the northern parts of the country, reinforcing the false notion that the practice only exists there. A 2018 U.S. State Department report indicates more than six witch camps are spread across the area and hold 2,000 to 2,500 women and 1,000 to 1,200 children. Some of these settlements are believed to have been set up about 100 years ago. Cynthia Morrison, Ghana's Minister for Gender, Children and Social Protection, says the lynching of a 90-year-old woman should have never happened in the 21st century. She says her ministry, along with the Parliamentary Select Committee on Women and Children, have embarked on a familiarization tour to witch camps to engage traditional authorities, families of the alleged witches, and the women themselves to draft a roadmap for closing them. Morrison says some of the women indicated that the camp serves as a safe haven after suffering abuse and torture in their communities.
"Wait, I'd rather die here. And so we'll go back with the traditional authorities because you cannot do anything without them. They are the custodians of the land here. And then we sit and if they want to be there, what do we do? If we have to reintegrate them to their community, what do we do? Some people have been there for over 10 years and nobody wants them anymore."
She says the chiefs and traditional authorities in the area where the camps are located have shown commitment to close them down, and the need now is for families of the alleged witches to accept them back.
"If the family members agree to receive them back home, we don't have any problem at all. I would wish that even going there, the family members were there to say that we are taking our mothers home. Then we'll have no issue at all. Because they are not staying kept there by compulsion. No, they are there because they see there as a safe haven and they refuse to go home. But if the family members are willing to take them, bingo, they go back home."
Robert Akoto Amwafo, director of Amnesty International Ghana, says abuse of women accused of witchcraft has long been neglected. He says the camps should be closed, but government needs to do more, noting that witchcraft accusations also happen in communities where people are accused and lynched, but the incidents are often not reported.
"For instance, clearly having a strategy towards ending that issue, the government putting a budget in place towards that issue, and we see Parliament making steps towards making laws to ban the issue of witchcraft accusations. in Ghana.
He says providing basic social amenities would enable communities to naturally integrate with the rich comes. Reporting for VOA, this is Mary Zotri in Ghana.
Now for entertainment. In recent years, two street musicians from Malawi, Yobu Maligwa and Yosef Kalekeni, have risen up from busking in Lilongwe to crushing show-stopping performances on some of the world's biggest music festivals. Earlier this week, Heather Maxwell joined up virtually with the guys and their manager, Neil Nayar, in Lilongwe to learn more about their story and their newest song, a collaboration with a Ukrainian trio.
That we just got a Facebook from a guy called Lesik in Ukraine. He said, it was a nice email. We love your music of Madalitsa. I play you when I go and DJ. It's lockdown. It's crazy. What about if we do an online collaboration? We'd never been to Ukraine. We've never played in Ukraine, but somehow he'd heard of the band and that was it.
How long have you guys been playing together, and how did you first start?
2001.
Just like a random meeting in Area 49 of Lilongwe in 2001, when Yosef was walking with a guitar, and they started chatting on the street, and they just got on with each other and said, hey, how about we start making some music together? That was it, a random meeting on the streets.
And so when did their career start really picking up? Because now, look, I mean, they're getting people, musicians from all over the world, from, you know, noticing them on Facebook and reaching out and saying, you know, asking to do collaborations. So how did they get from busking in the streets of Lilongwe to being noticed by other musicians worldwide asking to do collaborations with them?
Well, one simple festival in Zanzibar, but happened to be Sauti za Busara.
Not such a simple festival.
Yeah, there was a booker for Roskilde Festival in the audience. There was BBC in the audience. There was a record label in Switzerland in the audience. And these guys was their first time to play outside Malawi. But all of a sudden, people just came and asked us, like, hey, have these guys been in Europe? How, you know, we'd like to book them. And then it just started like that. And then their first tour was 2 weeks. The next one was 5 weeks, then 9 weeks. So they just had such a great impact. Then it sort of started picking up like that.
What culture are you representing exactly? I mean, Malawi, of course, but is there something more specific? Because we should mention that cool instrument that most people have never seen, I don't think, the babatone. So how are these things related? What culture are you representing?
Malawi.
Is it just for Malawi,
yeah,
or Kapena, like, can you say, like, more specific, like Ngoni, Kapena, Shishewa, Kapena?
I think Ngoni, Shishewa, Ngoni, Ashewa.
Because they're two different tribal backgrounds, Ngoni and Shewa, and so it's a representation of that kind of vibe, I suppose, particularly from the central region of Malawi.
And Yosefe, I noticed that your drum is basically your foot kicking against the side of a drum. So you're playing the drum basically with your foot, right? I like that.
All of Malawi, I've never seen anybody else play the drum like that, right?
Modalitsu Band and Neil Nayar, they're in Lilongwe, Malawi. Thank you so much for joining me, and I wish you the best of luck. I love your music.
Thank you.
Come on. Thank you. Thank you for having us.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiye Suhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Nadia Taha, thank you again for tuning in and choosing the Voice of America.